I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Actor Peter Bergman is an undisputed master of one particular corner of the acting world, the soaps. For 10 years, starting in 1979, he played Cliff Warner, the legendary good guy doctor on All My Children. Even if you've never seen a soap opera, you've heard this.
I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV.
After a headline-grabbing firing from All My Children, you'll hear more about that coming up, Bergman took on another of the most durable characters in the history of television, Jack Abbott on The Young and the Restless.
It does matter.
It's the role he still plays today, 30 years later.
I want answers!
Where Dr. Warner was a heartthrob good guy, Jack is deliciously complex. He's perpetually trying to live up to his father, cosmetics tycoon John Abbott, perpetually battling rival makeup baron Victor Newman.
The gods will side with me.
Perpetually remarrying Nikki Newman, Victor's ex.
I'm trying to be civil.
It's soap perfection. I should know, I too am a soap opera veteran. This is me in the early 80s on NBC's The Doctors.
Tell them you forgot something. Lie.
I have forgotten something.
What's that?
What it's like to make love to you.
A couple years after that, I died. Jack Abbott, despite numerous threats to his life and fortune, is still going strong, the star of the show even. And that says something, because when I started, it was the mature characters who got the juiciest stories. But now, with few exceptions, it's the younger generation who are the stars of the show.
Well, I have been both the young and the old. And I now call it the young and the rest of us.
You had your time.
Well, I'm very lucky. I am still in a prominent place in this company. And there are people behind me who are very unhappy to be behind me. I know that.
Well, I mean, obviously, you and I have daytime TV in common.
Right.
This one guy, David O'Brien, played my father, and he said to me, he said, don't mock the material. He said, don't make fun of it. He goes, that's not going to help you.
Yeah, yeah.
Try to make it work.
Yeah.
Don't send it up and bitch
about
it.
Or if you're going to do it first thing in the morning. Let's get all our laughs out early and play the absurdity of it all. And then let's all get together and see how good we can make this.
Yeah, we got to figure it out.
Yeah.
You were born in Cuba?
I was born in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Right. That's the, you know, Latin machismo thing that you see right away.
I mistake you for Julio Iglesias constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
What did your dad do?
My dad was in the Navy, a career Navy man, and we moved every 2 years of my life for what seemed like my entire life.
So you went to Guantanamo for very long.
We were in Guantanamo for probably 4 months. But strangely enough, I love Cuban music. I love Cuban food. I have a certain fascination and have not yet been.
Did you grow up primarily where? Was there one place that he settled for a while?
So by the time I was in ninth grade, we settled in Camp Springs, Maryland. Outside of Washington, D.C., near Andrews Air Force Base.
And Annapolis.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And moving every couple of years is an odd thing. You probably talk to plenty of actors who are from the military or from foreign service or things like that. Every couple of years you move, and, well, let's figure out what we got to do here. Who do I have to be for this group? And I was popular in the last place.
Did you go to public school?
And I went to public schools. Yeah, went to public
schools
all the time.
And did you have a drama bug there? Were you a movie nut?
No, I sang in a band for a couple of years, rock and roll cover stuff and played dances and things like that. So I had some nerve, but not any great talent for that. I certainly liked my television. I watched old movies occasionally, but not with the kind of fervor that that a lot of people watched it
all
with.
And that was a map for where you wanted to go.
I didn't have a map. Strangely enough, if there was an allegory for kind of my life in general, you know, the first couple of homes you bought, you thought, oh my God, how am I ever going to afford this? Yeah. How am I ever going to make this work? I, and somehow it works out. And then you go get another house and you think, I'm never going to be able to afford this one either. And you figure it out. The drama bug, strangely enough, was almost an accident. I was hanging out after school, 11th grade.
Maryland.
Yes, 11th grade. And there was a girl auditioning for the school play. And I hung out after school with Margot trying to get her attention. She saw right through me. I was kind of popular, and this was not, I was not a normal person to show up at auditions in the theater department. And so I asked, what are we auditioning for? She said, it's Peter Pan. Well, I knew this thing inside out. The Cyril Richard thing with Mary Martin was part of growing up. Right. And in my age, I'm a little older than you are. And it showed every year. And I was parked in front of that thing. And I
Who's the meanest of all? Captain Hook.
There you are. So there was a form to fill out, part reading for. And Margot handed it in. And when she handed it in, she stopped and wrote, Captain Hook. Only Captain Hook. I learned this much later.
Were you Captain Hook?
I was. well, it was a long process. It's because of Mr. Darling at the beginning. It's the largest role in the play, even bigger than Peter Pan, I mean, in terms of dialogue. And here you have a high school drama teacher who has his group, the people he can count on. He knows who's probably going to play Captain Hook, who's probably going to play Peter Pan. And in comes this guy who is just... I had nothing to lose. I just didn't care.
In a good way.
So
and did that launch more school plays?
Yes, it did. Got me going. I was a pretty lost kid. Pretty lost.
Was the moving around a part of that?
I think there was a big part of it.
I just want to have a home.
Yeah, there's a lot to some that. Of it. Going back to my audition, mine was an endless process that included I learned later, the head of the drama department, Mr. Messina, just passed away last year. I went to the teacher's lounge and said, I got this weird thing going on. I got this guy who keeps coming in and auditioning really, really well. I haven't even heard of him. Well, who? Peter Bergman. No. He's kind of all over the place. And then I went in there, and the last night I had to read How Still the Night Is. Nothing sounds alive. Now is the hour when all children in their homes are abed, their lips bright brown with the goodnight chocolate, their tongues drowsily searching for belated crumbs housed emptily in their swollen cheeks. I'm in 11th grade. This is the coolest thing I have ever read in my life.
Yeah. What a thing to develop a passion for that language then.
Oh,
I love it. Because when I was in high school, I did a high school play. We did Mr. Roberts, and the drama coach said to me, ask some of your friends on the football team if they want to come do Mr. Roberts or whatever. And I was half in, half out. I didn't really care. But for you, when you leave home, you go to New York.
After high school, I go to community college nearby for a year and a half.
And studied what?
English. And they were auditioning for a play. And I was, I won a Best Actor Award at a time. Another school was doing a show called Celebration. And the guy was so much better than I was. And I won. And it drove me crazy.
Really?
He was so good.
Why do you think you won? Did he look like a cadaver? Was he not a good-looking guy?
I don't know. He was he was great. So I'm at community college, and there's a poster for auditions for Celebration. I can make this right. I can be better than he was in the same role.
And did you?
And I did.
And how were
I did.
You?
And it worked out pretty well for me. It really did. While in that play, one of the castmates, a fellow I had just met, who became a lifelong friend, Tim Van Pelt, was playing another role, and he was going to New York to audition for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Yeah.
And I had no aspirations, no plans, no anything. I said,
you just wanted to be better than that other guy.
I just wanted to be better than that other guy.
Who was looking over your shoulder?
In the play, who was looking over my shoulder the whole time. I got to New York with two audition pieces. One was from Chekhov's The Boar. And I had quickly, they'd sent an audition book, and I looked through the ones, and I liked the words of the Chekhov, the boar. It was regal and stentorious and full of charm and dignity. And I finished my audition, and the fellow who was running the auditions, who was one of the big shots at the school, said, okay, very nice, can sit down. So did you get a chance to read the play? He said, yeah, this guy is the boar. He's a beast. He's a dreadful
he's not
person.
George Sanders.
George Sanders, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, he was able to overlook that, but it kind of marks the beginning of my cheating to get there.
The foundation of your career?
The foundation of my career is false and ugly.
But he let you in.
He let me in because I was, I think, honest with him. And he maybe saw something in my thing. And I was a tall, straight white guy.
Right.
And, so yes, I spent 2 years there. And in that time, got to play many roles. Again, because I was a tall, straight guy, yeah. and they gave me a lot of the really plum roles, and I started to take it seriously, but still not seriously enough. A lot came too easily to me. Mm-hmm. A lot came too easily to me.
Did you think at any time that this wasn't enough? Because like, I know that when I went into it, I thought people said to me, "Why didn't you study this?" I went to GW for political science for 3 years full time, and people said to me, "Why didn't you study drama?" And I thought, "Oh God, what a waste of my parents' money—a degree in theater. That's useless." Did you think the same thing?
No, I didn't. I honestly was just lazy. I just was lazy, and I'm embarrassed to say that. And I've spent the second half of my life catching up with all of that, you know, making right all of those things. So again, I'm faking my way through. And in that time, I met the woman who was to be my wife then, Christine Ebersole.
Of course.
Who has quite the Broadway career. And Christine and I were together for 5 years, still good friends, and I'm very grateful. She's married to a lovely, lovely
you
man.
You met her when you were at American Academy?
Met her at the American Academy. She was upstairs playing Joni Mitchell on one of the pianos, and I'm a big Joni Mitchell fan, and I just loved the sound of that was coming out of that room. And then
How soon after you left American Academy did you get married?
Another year. Yeah,
both of us
unemployed.
Living where?
Living on the Upper East Side, 82nd between 1st and York. And Christine's career took off well before mine.
Right.
And all of what I told you in the lack of preparation and the inability to take seriously enough that this is a choice that people make big sacrifices for this. I'd heard all of this talk and everything. I just wanted to be a working actor, you know, whatever, you know. And it didn't happen for me. And I found out I wasn't terribly good at hustling, wasn't terribly good at getting out there and just knocking doors down to make it all happen.
Pushing.
I waited a lot of tables.
Can you name a place that was like your house? You know, I was a waiter at Studio 54.
Oh, okay. So
when they were closing down.
So I worked at a few places. Sign of the Dove. I worked there. I did Garadon service and all of that business. And then I finished my waiting career at Rusty Staub's joint on 3rd Avenue.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about New York, when you talk about New York then, I get to New York in 1979. And Studio 54 is over. No one's going. I was a waiter. You know, the bus boys were the ones that wore the kind of Roman slave boy outfits with the little short shorts and no shirts. And they were all muscled up and greased up. And I would go there and we'd ice the place and clean all the glass. Everything was ready. And I turned to this one and all the waiters were male models. They were all gorgeous and not always young. Some of them were like 35. I mean, for me, that was older. I was 22. And I'd sit there, and they were the loveliest guys. They treated me like I was their kid brother. And I said, and the music is playing, and nobody's there. It's empty. And it's 9 o'clock. We've been there since 6:30, and we're cleaning everything, and I'm stocking everything. And I go, what do we do now? It's like a child. I go, well, what do we do now? And they go, what do we do now? And they all pour drinks, and we do lines of Coke on the bar. We're all dancing on the club.
I'll
show you what we do now. And it was the craziest, dumbest thing. But that thing of waiting in New York, I mean, I did that for a while.
I do too.
Yeah.
And I'm quick to say, I liked waiting tables. It was performing. It was finding out whether they were looking for a butler to come to the table or they were looking for a charming fellow to just knock their socks off.
Now, when you're there, you're waiting, you're there. You were involved in some theater company.
I was indeed.
On one hand, if you don't mind my saying so, it sounds contradictory. You're not very ambitious and you're not very, driving yourself, but you form a theater company.
Well, yes. So life was catching up with me. So you could only fake it so long. And I was learning that quickly. And as I watched Christine's career start to take off, I started seeing that some investment is really important here. And I started studying with a fellow named Bob Smith, a very famous a Shakespeare scholar who worked Stratford for a very long time.
And you done much Shakespeare before that?
And I had done a bit at school, and it was language that I liked and mm-hmm. worked for me. That went on for some time, well into all my children. And then I was one of the heads of the company and putting all my children money into these productions that we were doing.
So the two overlapped.
So they overlapped.
You started the theater company when?
Yeah, yeah. 1979.
You started All My Children
when? 1979. I got the job at All My Children from Rusty's, and I was so proud of myself, I gave them a two-week notice. I worked with plenty of people who the day they got the job, they were gone the next day. And I was so proud of myself. I gave them a two-week notice and left in some glory to this job. And then I get to All My Children. And the audition story, again, supports this thing we keep talking about. You got to be prepared for these things. Yeah. You got to, you know. I had three auditions that day. I had a commercial audition in the morning. Everybody looked just like I did. And I walked in there and it was, you know, I had to wear a suit. It was summertime. It was... I went from that back to the York Theater, where I had been yesterday reading a new Tennessee Williams play called Vieux Carré, directed by José Quintero.
Okay, there we go.
So I read the play the day before. I went back there and spent a couple hours working on the sides for what I was auditioning for. You had to read it all backstage. And I stepped out on the stage and... everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Just right out of the gate, I was just horrible. It was I lost my place. And a very sweet voice from the audience said, "Thank you."
Yeah.
And I left and I went back to my apartment so disconsolate. I was having growing concerns that I was not cut out for this. This was not the right idea. I'm not good enough. I'm not ready to do the work. I'm not. There's something wrong with me. And I got to my apartment and Ricky, my agent, I was with Don Buchwald and Company. I don't know if that name crossed your career.
Legendary voiceover agent.
Right, exactly, right. And Ricky called me, as she never did, to follow up on auditions and said, "How'd it go?" I said, "It was awful. I was awful. I am awful. You should get rid of me. This was a horrible audition. Terrible. And I got to get off the phone, Ricky." She said, "Don't forget, you have that All My Children audition this afternoon." I don't even know why I agreed to do this thing.
And you go.
She had kind of talked me into, it's work, whatever, and, you know. And I
for,
went there.
For
and
a
I,
role
and,
or for and, like an under five or like a part?
For a role. For a role.
For
a role.
For the role.
For the role.
Right.
And I went there and I didn't know anything about any of it, but I didn't care. I just didn't care. If I get this, if I don't get this, I'm doing this.
That's often how you win.
Because there you are. And I went in and everything that could go right did go right. I'm in the lobby.
You're
and
vulnerable.
Everyone's paired off. Everyone's paired off and cute little couples and everything. And it's me standing there and Mark Lemuro walks through and I knew him from a Kojak episode I'd done a while back. And he says, who are you with? And I said, I should be partner. And in walks this sweet blonde girl who was just oh, she was just adorable. And she was so open and kind and lovely and absolutely appropriate for the scene that I was doing with her. And we kind of paired off and she was scared and I kind of hustled her through the thing because we got to get
Who was it?
We got to, I wish I could remember her name. She didn't.
That's so funny.
Yeah. What I didn't know was this was the beginning of this wave of daytime craziness.
Yep.
When I started, there were 13 soap operas. There are four now. They were all doing well, but ABC in particular, that love in the afternoon thing.
Loving.
Got to go. Yes, starting
Beck
with Loving, Ryan's Hope, All My Children, One Life to Live, General Hospital, this juggernaut.
David O'Brien, my father said, he said, let me give you a piece of advice. He said, when we're not working, he says, always refer to the other soaps and our own soap in French. We say them in French because it'll make it seem more serious to you.
And tout mes enfants.
L'espère de voyons.
Tout mes enfants.
Tout mes enfants. Les gens et les.
Our show in France is
Belle.
Le feu de l'amour, the fire of love.
The fire of love.
But it was crazy. There were 12, 13 million people watching us every day.
It was the
day.
Height of that program.
College campuses were just on shutdown for 3 hours during the day. Everyone scheduled their classes around this. Elizabeth Taylor came out of the closet as the great General Hospital fan. Carol Burnett couldn't stop.
Did she walk on?
Yes, she did.
Yeah,
Carol Burnett couldn't stop talking about All My Children. She too came on. I got to work with her on the show.
Susan Lucci.
Susan Lucci, of course, was the far and away the most important person there. So I was in one of those pretty two-dimensional roles that you describe. All of those the love story kind of things. I was young Lochinvar. And that was my job. But here I am on the soap opera, and my first couple of days, I walked in the makeup room and heard people talking about plays they saw last night. Thought, oh, wait a minute. And pretty intelligent conversation. And then I'm introduced to Eileen Hurley. Eileen Hurley was Gertrude to Olivier's Hamlet in the film, and then I and one by one.
You're reading my mail here, yeah.
Oh my gosh!
I did the show, and I would say to these people, Jim Pritchett, who looked like Burt Reynolds' father with that mustache, David O'Brien, who played my father. I could name so many more of them. Who the theater, especially the doctors at 30 Rock. In Midtown, half hour, so much of the cast, all theater-centric. O'Brien would get his break, and I said, what are you going to do during your break? He said, I'm going to go do King John at the Paper Mill Playhouse.
There you are.
And they would pre-tape and spring early in the day the cast who had to be at a Broadway
matinee. Exactly. We had the same thing. We changed the schedule again and again to get people out for curtains.
Some very serious actors in this company.
Exactly. So New York soaps were a great thing because all of these Broadway actors who
were make some dough,
were
pension, welfare, medical.
Yeah.
Everybody in the old after contract. Yeah. People don't realize it's like, you're in New York. And people just want to make it's like what Law and Order also did.
Right.
Who the hell wasn't on Law and Order? You know, at some point. I mean, it seems like everybody was.
And so I'm around people, the David Canaries and the James Mitchells. And I'm telling you what these guys did on these shows. Oh, my God. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
It was absolute. I would watch with wonder at what these actors could do.
Taping the TV show.
Taping the show I'm on.
Right.
I'm stunned.
So eventually, did you have any, I'm assuming when you're one of the stars of these shows, and you are indeed one of the stars of these shows during that 10 years you were there.
10 years.
Do the writers and do the producers come to you and start to say to you, what do you want to do?
That never happens. That never, ever happens.
No.
What do you want to play? That job came to an end before I was ready for it to come to an end.
Why?
And a confluence of things happening at exactly the wrong time, or it turns out exactly the right time.
I'm sure. Soap opera star Peter Bergman. I've interviewed one other daytime Emmy winner on this program, and that, believe it or not, is Julianne Moore.
she won in 1988 for her work as Franny Hughes and Franny's twin sister Sabrina on As the World Turns.
The dialogue is so rough, so basic. All you're doing is establishing story. I used to do what they called emotion. I called it anyway, emotional applique, where if I had to say something that was really just plot oriented, I'd try to like cry on top of it or laugh on top of it or anything just to make it mean something.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah, because it's all exposition.
My interview with Julianne Moore, It's Not Just About Soaps, is in our archive at heresthething.org. More with Peter Bergman when we return. I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing. Actor Peter Bergman is Jack Abbott on The Young and the Restless, but before then, he was dashing, rich Dr. Cliff Warner on All My Children, married most of the time, to Nina Cortland. Their relationship was on the cover of Soap Opera magazine throughout the 80s. Soaps.com, and if it's not bookmarked, it should be, puts them first in a list of soap opera supercouples. The couple even has its own Wikipedia entry. Nina Cortland was played by Taylor Miller.
If I had to name the seven most important women in my life, Taylor Miller would be in there.
I remember all their names.
We rode the crest of this
Gracie
daytime
Harrison
wave
was
together.
My wife. Yeah. Jada Rowland was my mother.
Jada Rowland.
You're on this juggernaut.
Crazy.
And when it ends, you didn't think it was going to end? You weren't prepared for it to end?
I wasn't prepared for it to end.
They killed you?
No. They sent Taylor and I off in the sunset. This is what the audience wants anyway. She wants to leave. She wants to go have a family and have a life in Chicago with her husband. And so she's leaving.
The actress.
So we had a brand new executive producer, brand new head writer, had no personal commitment to the history of the show or the character I played or anything, and they kind of said, you know what, we'll just let them both go off in the sunset.
You wanted to do his own thing, make his mark,
and the producer. And I was just hammered by it.
Really?
It's going on without me. I found a home. And again, this goes back to the military thing.
Yeah.
I had found a home, and I had made myself a member of that family in a big way.
And it ended, and how long did you stay after it ended?
So they
notify you, then you got to hang in there.
Exactly right. So they me know in late January, and I worked till September 6th.
Wow.
It was a long time.
Yeah.
It was nasty, and I would love to tell you I was strong enough to pick myself up, dust myself off, and get on to the next thing. And I was thunderstruck by it. My wife was 7 months pregnant with our second child. We had just bought the apartment next door and joined the two. I met her through a blind date. My friend Michael had introduced us.
And what was she doing?
And she was working at 30 Rock. She worked in NBC Sports for the guy that did contracts for everything. And
where you go on a blind
date? We went to Odeon downtown.
Very
and with Michael and Mary Ellen's cousin Beth,
who's Michael?
Okay, here's a good twist.
Michael Nader.
Michael Miner.
Michael Miner. Who's that?
Any bells?
Michael.
Okay,
Miner.
I have a story for you. 3 years ago, my closest friend in the world died.
Not Mike Miner, who lived in my building. Not Mike Miner, who was on Petticoat Junction.
Mike Miner.
I lived in his building.
I know that. I know that very well.
I live on 10th Street.
I know that very well.
Mike Miner was in my building.
I promised myself today, I had no reason to do this, Alec. I'm on a very busy schedule right now. This was an opportunity to say thank you for being a good guy to my friend Michael in some of his darkest days.
Oh,
I'm telling you, you're being kind to him outside your building, in your lobby, right, would sometimes make his week.
Oh, God.
And this is a guy who had quite a career.
I mean, I said to my wife, I get a picture from Petticoat Junction, and he's the boyfriend, strapping, good-looking, super handsome guy. And I turn to my wife and I go, that's Mike Miner that we know who lives across the hallway from us. Because he really smoked himself into a therapy.
Well, he died of a lifetime of bad choices. He was, talked to him all the time.
Struggled to take care of their health.
One of the great sense of humors of all time. I don't know if you ever met him on All My Children.
He was on All My Children.
He was there for a couple of years and Susan Lucci's boyfriend on the show. So Michael and I were on All My Children together, became fast friends. And in that time, Beth McCauley, who's from Massapequa, Long Island.
That's where I'm from.
I know that.
This is weird.
So Mike Miner and Beth McCauley from Massapequa took us to Odeon. Beth had said, my cousin's here, and said to Michael, who can we hook her up with? And he said, she's a redhead. I'll call Bergman. And that's how I'm married 34 years now. So anyway, we had a delicious first date in New York.
Especially when you're younger and it's all new. It's nice to be in New York with money in your pocket.
Oh, yeah. It was the greatest thing. I had a ticket agent. I had somebody, I called Frank, and I told him I just read about a play I want to see. Yeah. And I would get a monthly bill from Frank. And they were at will call.
Yeah.
I would just go, and I had.
When I first moved there, and I had jobs, and I would, you know, I would make a little dough. I mean, it was, I just couldn't stop going to see everything.
Just magical
time. It becomes an addiction.
And I was able to drag Michael into those kind of things.
So your first marriage ends when? While you're on the soap?
My first marriage ends while I'm on the soap, while I'm somewhat new on the soap. It was...
And that in itself is a soap.
That in itself is a soap. And that in itself is... I mean, I don't know anybody who has a good divorce story. It was just...
I don't.
It wasn't ugly. You don't.
I know that I don't.
But you know, it was a terrible time. It was really sad, very painful, cutting away the support system you'd built around yourself for a long time. Yeah. And I'm very proud of the fact that Christine and I did manage to keep a friendship all that time. We had some mutual friends who we stayed in touch with, and I was literally at a wedding with her last summer, and I've loved seeing her successes.
Everybody worships her,
and she's fantastic.
She's closing night of when they did the, I don't want to say it was the workshop or whatever you want to call this. Early, I think was it Playwrights when they
it was did, it Playwrights, yeah,
when
yeah.
they oh, did the Great Gardens. Gardens,
yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
She brought the house down. Yeah. Yeah. She's so talented. But when you, how soon after you get divorced, you get remarried?
So I got remarried probably 3-4 years later.
Yeah.
I married this just amazing woman. Oh God. Everybody should be loved like I am loved.
Yeah. You're lucky. When does L.A. become an idea?
The three things I was not going to do when All My Children ended, I was not going to replace anybody. Replacements didn't kind of work on All My Children when characters left. I was not going to do another soap right away. I'm doing a soap right now, and I was not moving to L.A. There's no way.
What happened?
There's no way. I moved to L.A., replaced somebody.
Well, I know that. Whose idea was all that?
So I'm unemployed on the shores of Fairfield Beach, where we had a summer house we'd already paid for.
Get away.
Yeah, Fairfield, right. Connecticut. Everyone else was going out to Long Island and Fire Island and the Hamptons. And we went to Fairfield, Connecticut.
It
was swell, right in the water. I was walking up and down that beach, and I got a call from my agent saying, The Young and the Restless just called and want to know how tall you are.
If you want to come out here and spend the rest of your life, I'm going to pay you bags of money.
It was.
How's that sound?
How tall, they wanted to know, am I? And I said, what? Don't even call them back. So what I didn't know is Young and the Restless had lost an actor named Terry Lester, who had played the character of Jack Abbott for 10 years, very popular character. He had decided to move on. And the executive producer was married to one of the stars of the show. And the two of them were off on their way to Canada in a flight, and she had all
who
these Melody Thomas Scott and Ed Scott on a flight to Canada. She had some of her soap opera magazines with her, and I'm on the cover of all of them. I was not a likely person to get let go of. I wasn't on anybody. It was a surprise to everybody. So I was on the cover of all of these magazines. And she turned to Ed, and they'd already tested six guys, and it
had gone. Who's the producer that fired you?
She was summarily dismissed in the same way I was.
I hope she's selling hot dogs in Toronto. Yes.
So Melody Thomas Scott turns to her husband and says, "That's Jack." And he said, "Okay, we'll find out how tall he is first."
Right.
So that's how that first call happened.
You know, in New York, we always had a very kind of looking down our nose at the Los Angeles soaps. Like in New York, you went to the theater and you went to the symphony and you went to the, restaurants, and it was New York. And out here, everybody was fit and everybody looked perfect.
Yeah.
You've heard all the names. We call it the show The Hung and the Breastless.
Oh, yeah.
And all those put down names. When you get out here and you start the show,
it was night and day. I went from standing in the makeup room talking about the show last night, and I got here and everyone was off in their dressing rooms. There were people that were on the same episode that I was on for the first 2 months I was there, and I never met them. I never clapped eyes on them. I never saw them in the makeup room. Everybody was off in their own world. Probably developing new ideas for something. And, it was so different than anything. I walked out on the set and there were cue cards everywhere. Cue cards?
Yeah.
But here's the cool thing. After 10 years of watching a couple of guys have those roles, the role, I've got the role on this show.
It's about you.
It's about me, and this is a mercurial character. One day, the nicest brother anybody could ever have. The next day, a despotic boss and dreadful, manipulative, venal, self-centered idiot. The next day, a careful, kind lover. The next day, it was one of the roles.
Right.
I got one of the roles in daytime, and it took off, and I was there a year and a half when I won my first Emmy.
You won three or four?
I won three.
You've been nominated for like 500 daytimes?
I don't.
A lot. 20-something.
Number 21?
I read it. 21. I'm joking, but
21 nominations.
You were nominated for a lot of them, and you won a few.
Yeah, and I won a few.
And when you were there and you're doing the show, what happens to you in terms of the culture of living in Los Angeles?
Slowly, as the kids grow up and I get to coach their basketball teams and we get to meet their friends and school starts and I got to liking it more and more. But the first 7 years, I fought this with everything. We kept our apartment for 7 years.
Yeah.
We kept our apartment on West 90th Street between Central Park West and Columbus for the first 7 years.
Oh, you're kidding.
We were there.
I lived in the El Dorado for 20 years.
Is that
you were near Trinity?
Yeah.
I met my wife.
El Dorado is at the end of that block.
Right? No, Trinity is on 91st. So you're near Turin Liquors.
Right, there you are.
So there, this is, I don't want to get into this now, but it's like, I'm not sure I want to live in New York anymore.
I get that. It's a pretty hard life. Had I to do this all over again, I fought it tooth and nail, dragged kicking and screaming to the best thing that ever happened to me. Had I to do it over again, the first day I would have bought a surfboard. And the second day I would have bought a set of golf clubs.
Right.
And I would have embraced life in Southern California.
Rome.
I was standing there saying, this is a cultural wasteland. Who would live here? Yeah. As soon as this job is over, I'm headed back to New York. Yeah. I fought it with everything in me.
Some people do that. That's right.
I've come to embrace it.
But if you're healthy, I was one of the great LA haters of all time, and you learn to make peace with it. You get a break for how much in your contract? You have off?
I have off 2 weeks in December.
That's it.
I have vacation time. I have outs in my contract, but the way outs work is they have to cast it so far ahead of time. Right. I would do a play. Plays are harder.
Last play you
harder
did was
to,
when?
Harder to do. It's quite a while ago.
Right, got it.
Quite a while ago. So it would be.
How's the taping schedule change? Because everybody told me, like Kim Zimmer would tell me years ago when they reconstituted Guiding Light, and they were like. I can't remember whether they were going to cancel it or they did cancel it or whatever. And they said to them, we're going to shoot multiple episodes. We're going to block shoot.
Is that what you're doing now? That's the norm now. So we tape 5 or 6 shows in 4 days. We only work Tuesday through Friday. Not because it gives the actors a break, but because it's less expensive. And we pretty much everything's in one take, which is both good and bad. If I can get time with you to rehearse in our dressing rooms, let's do it in one take.
Yeah.
My first take's always my best.
Yeah.
Always has been. Doing third and fourth take, that's what I don't
understand. When you
are doing film and somebody's asking you for take 9, I don't know how you do that. I'd go out of my mind. I'd start adding words. I'd start, you know,
I like to do 6 or 8 takes myself to play with it. But for me, it's like, you know that I don't like to do 30 takes. I mean, I've been around people like that who are a little nutty.
But everything's in one take. We do things if you flub, we'll pick it up. For the most part, in scenes with me, and I say this is with as much modesty as I can muster, my job is to find you, and you and I are going to build this scene together. Sometimes they don't have time to direct at all.
Right.
So the conversation you and I have about what has to happen in this scene is a critical conversation.
The directors are flight controllers.
They are, and not because they're any less than the directors we once had, but because it's going so fast, they are in a pressure cooker. They're making camera shots work like crazy because we're directing on the fly with camera changes and things like that. So it's up to actors. So we've run this, you and I know this thing inside out before we ever go out there. Or I haven't done my job.
When I did 30 Rock, they always gave me like the real lengthy speeches. I would do, the character was windy, and they'd have him, and I would hold forth for like a page and a half, two pages. Yeah. And I never memorized the night before because I knew they would change it. And I knew I'd come in and say,
we don't have that. Yeah.
So I would sit down in the makeup chair and memorize. And I was a good study.
You have to.
What kills me, people don't get this. They say to me, I would have, you know, quite a few people during my career, they say, boy, you're very good at memorizing your lines. You do this so quickly. I said, I was on a soap.
Yep.
I said, I was on a soap.
Yep.
You had to memorize, if it was a 30-page script, I was in 23 pages of it, and I said the same thing 15 different ways. Greta, I love you. Greta, please don't leave me. Greta, please. Don't you understand, Greta?
Yes.
You know, those environments, it's intense, even before this block shooting now, when the old way where you shot a show a day, maybe.
It's pressure. It's a pressure cooker.
And the peacock men, I'm not getting into the story of your show, but the peacock men who are the leads, men who drive the show, people don't understand that there's a little competition there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you have to hold your own, but it demands a kind of faith in each other that I'm not just protecting my character. How about I make you look really good and you make me look really good? This is the Peter Bergman school of doing this.
Yeah,
and I can beat you down. If you want to go toe to toe where you're going to embarrass me or you're going to, in a scene in daytime television, you're not going to do that to me.
No,
unlikely. That much I can handle. And so when you say, you know, the big guys protecting their turf, there's a little bit of that, but I hate that stuff.
I had a little bit of that. Now, for you, a couple less things I want to ask you. The soap opera culture, the fans, David O'Brien said to me, they know you, they watch you every day. It's not like nighttime TV. Right, he said, they see you every day. And he said, a relationship has formed. And when they meet you, they're ready for that relationship to go to the next level.
There are different kinds of fame. Someone runs into Robert Redford on the street. What do you really say? Liked your movie with I love The Natural. What are you, Butch Cassidy?
Usually they just say, "Oh my God!"
They could have a half-hour conversation with me without ever discussing me or the role I play. A half-an-hour discussion. So there is this kind of sense of ownership that we run into quite often with this kind of fame. He's in my living room every day. Of course I know him. I'm not going to talk. I'm not going to back off. I'm going to talk to him.
Who is Jack married to now?
Jack is not married right now.
He's not.
Yeah. I've lost 4 wedding rings by my characters not being married and being out on the set and having the wardrobe guy go, psst, psst.
Yeah.
And pointing to my ring finger. Oh, yeah. And I take it off and I put it in my costume, never to see it again.
I safety pin it something. Yeah. I can't. If I lost my wedding, my
but, wife. But no, Jack's not married right now, and Jack is now de facto the head of the Abbott family, and there are really only 2 big families in town: the Newmans and the Abbotts. And
30 years.
30 years.
How do you want Jack to go out? Or can you even say? You're trying to think about
you know,
that?
There. I want him to be dragged off to prison for putting Victor through a wall. There's a character who's been his nemesis for the entire time he's been there.
Braden.
And it is written in the stars that he has to win every battle. Victor, Eric Braden's character.
Always wins.
Always wins. I want to win one major
rematch.
Battle and be dragged out screaming off to the penitentiary. Yes. That's Jack's last day.
You're in Rome.
I like it.
And by the time the battle is over, you're holding him down.
And as we close in on his face, he has to make the choice. Do you pull up? But I've just been through too much. I'm just going to hold his face down.
If over 30 years, hundreds of writers and producers had forced you to lose to your arch enemy over and over again, well, you might have that kind of fantasy too. The kind, gracious, and very talented Peter Bergman appears today and tomorrow and the day after that at 12:30 on your local CBS station. That's 11:30 Central. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is a production of WNYC Studios.